Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arcanal.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of June 10th, 2024. So Lee, I was going to start off, and it's kind of an interesting article, or I guess report. You know, they have those yearly reports, but this one's more about pen tests. And it says the top 10 critical pen test findings, which is interesting because I think the things that were listed were only nine, but maybe I was looking at a different part of the report. But it's by Bonahe is the group that pushed the report out. And, you know, it's an interesting report. They kind of flow through what different types of pen tests there are, kind of like educating people like with the purpose and the values and the different services associated with those. But what I always like to focus on and why I really brought this report out was a lot of times what's interesting about pen testers is they're always addressing different networks across different verticals, different organizations. And they kind of, when you talk to them, they kind of sum up that, yeah, everyone has the same deficiencies. Like, oh yeah, this one always works, you know, this technique or this, you know, we always attack this way. And then they'll sometimes, if you talk to them long enough, you can say, well, if people aren't doing that, what do you typically do? And they can give you really good insight as far as not just how your network looks, but what's the problems they're seeing as a whole. And that's why I think this report's valuable. And I like this list. I'm going to just kind of highlight the things they mention, because it's a good idea when you're thinking about your security posture and your priorities, where I think an organization should really prioritize when they look at, oh, new vulnerability came out, or we just discovered this problem on our network. Like, how should we handle it? Immediate? Do we have time? What does that look like? And so I'll run down the list. At the top of the list is weakened default passwords. We know that that's, you know, an eyesore for everybody when people don't change those. And also it's one of the first things a lot of people will check, and especially for devices that aren't commonly interacted with. Like a good example where I found this on a network was a UPS. Right? A system that actually controls power to things. I think you were actually with me when I discovered that when we were working together back in the past.
Yeah. But and at the time where we took that like couple nights of night shift string where we just like kind of plugged away to see.
Oh, just network devices.
That was different network devices. But yeah.
But yeah, so it's one of those things where it's often overlooked when it's not a system that is being used all the time, or it's like, especially if it's a system that's not very sophisticated, but it's still attached to the network. But something worth looking at. And it's always good to, that's a good thing that a lot of pen testers always look for as well to clean up. The next one on the list was unpatched software. That's not as easy to solve for everybody. But obviously that's where a lot of people do take advantage of things. Misconfigured security settings. I think this is actually comes up more often than unpatched software, because sometimes unpatched software might kind of help people get in the door certain places. But for people to really take advantage of an environment, I think the misconfigured security settings, when it comes to either visibility or it comes to preventing certain types of lateral moves or what that looks like, that becomes an important thing. Lack of encryption. This one is, you know, always something to consider, because there's certain parts of the environment where you probably don't need to be as concerned, but something to consider as far as where is data moving, who would have visibility to it. Because especially when it comes to like your sensitive data, sometimes that's what pen testers will actually use to say, look, we were able to hurt you because we got access to this and we can read this. Inadequate access controls. This is a good one to really, I think, pay attention to. This just comes back to, you know, if you have, say, an admin that has access to everything versus admins that have access to what they actually work on. It can be a pain sometimes to set some things up, but man, when you set it up right or you get it set up in a logical way, it makes almost life easier when it comes to managing, in my opinion. But one of the next ones on the list is, I think, a big one, egress filtering. A lot of times some companies filter in, but not out. And I feel like adversaries have a much easier time when it comes to phishing. They're going to come in through things that are already allowed.
But if you force them to go out certain ways, it's easier to monitor and also prevent certain things from happening.
So I can't believe you passed up this. So inadequate access control. I can't believe you glossed over this, but you've spent a lot of time and effort using one of your favorite tools, looking at nested behaviors from, I believe it was an Active Directory perspective.
Yep.
I mean,
Active Directory attack passive Bloodhound.
So I'm not going to try and even do that justice. Do you want to like spend some time on it and talk about your findings and how like significant this one is?
Yeah. So really the most significant thing in that, kind of going with access controls and setting up logical groups for things, you know, just mapping out really large environments, especially companies that have multiple acquisitions, because you're kind of like, I got to bring in everything over here and it's got to work a certain way and I got to bond it to mine. And also when you have groups upon groups upon groups, you have this huge nesting of groups. Sometimes people get access to things that they don't really know they have access to, or there could be one misconfiguration that all of a sudden opens up, you know, Pandora's box if it gets discovered to have the access that they don't need, but an adversary would love to have. And so in the past, I've seen where how Bloodhound graphically shows things is it's like a spider web, right? And it's and so you can kind of follow from a start node and kind of connect the dots essentially. But what I look for when I was mapping things out are like circular patterns, because sometimes it's interesting when you're like, oh, I remove someone from this group, so that path is gone, but then you can see another group has the same access. So you effectively didn't remove their access. They have it through some other groups means or whatever. Sometimes that makes sense, right? Sometimes some groups have need access to the same thing. But when you can see those types of shapes in the graph, you can immediately say, we might have a problem here with how things are set up. And there's a lot of that. And sometimes you know, it'd be daisy chained down to, like 10 levels removed, right? As far as access goes. So even people that manage Active Directory with normal Active Directory tools can't see that level. It's really hard to stitch that together. And then, of course, an attack tool does a really good job of it. But that's why that information is really important. But it's very easy to see those access controls. And what's nice about Bloodhound today is they've also enriched a lot of the why that access is bad. For instance, like they'll enumerate like, well, they has this access gives you the ability to change objects in Active Directory. Or this one gives you, you know, X. So it can show you how you can kind of level up just based on some of those accesses. So yeah, one of my favorite tools, and also a great way to identify and help address some of those problems, because people should really, I mean, role-based access makes sense, and Bloodhound helps define that, because you can say these people have the same job function, they have the same access, we can see that.
If you're like me and his data manipulation blows your mind, imagine it's like the cybersecurity version of the Kevin Bacon effect.
Like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Yep.
Yeah. So inadequate access controls, I think that gets a lot of people in trouble, more than a lot of other things listed on the list. Besides egress filtering, that usually has a lot more to do with impact. You look at ransomware and exfilling data out, a lot of times they're usually legitimate services, you know, with HTTP and things going to specific domains that are meant to move data. But yeah, and then they mention buffer overflow vulnerabilities. That's just a big one. When you see vulnerabilities that have buffer overflows, sometimes it can lead to like an app crash, right? But usually anything that's denial of service based that's associated with that means that you're kind of one step away from potentially executing code because you have access to the memory. And as long as you don't stomp something important, then you now are able to execute things that you want to execute. So those vulnerabilities are always good to clean up. Like if you see a buffer overflow, even if it's not a critical because they don't have it tied to remote code execution, doesn't mean it can't be in the future. They mentioned information disclosure is a big thing. That's just because as pen testers and they come in, they need to learn environment really fast. And they're looking for any way they can kind of assess the environment in ways that not be detected, because they don't necessarily want to use a bunch of scanners and things that a lot of tools will alert on. So sometimes they take advantage of some vulnerabilities to give them more information. So that should be known. And then third-party vulnerabilities, that's just a hard one because you don't know some of your dependencies sometimes with party libraries, but something to consider. So what are your thoughts? What do you think when you kind of looked at the list or see a report like this?
So reading this report, of course, you know, the first thing you want to do is go to see, okay, well, what is the main potatoes of this report? What are they even talking about? What are the significant findings? And then you start thinking about, like, well, how does that look like? What does that look like in my environment? I will say what I really liked about this report was how it started from the basics, because I'm always a fan of that, like that slow walk, crawl, run idea, or crawl, walk, run, where they're breaking down the different types too. Because if this is trying to inform the viewers or the readers of, you know, what penetration testing you're looking for, it's good that they broke it all down, because not every penetration test is the same. Like, you know, talking about black box where, you know, the testers have like no information whatsoever, just like, unless there was, you know, some internal documentation that they said, here's their scope, here's what you can do, but really they're kind of like in the dark. Then you go to white box where it's, hey, you know what, you know, here's all the information we have, we just got to figure out what's vulnerable. Gray box, you know, that in between. But it's really nice that they broke it down and stepped forward and even discussed that. And then all the phases of it that you should expect. So it's a real good capture of, these are all the things. It's not just, I want a penetration test, let me go buy one and you get one. I also like how they drew the line between vulnerability assessment and penetration test. And I think you mentioned it earlier too, because those are two, you approach those things completely different. You know, vulnerabilities, a patch comes out and you're like, okay, let's scan our environment. And we have, there's tools that are specifically designed for that. Let's scan the environment. Let's see which ones match up to the version that is mentioned in the patch. And then, you know, go forward with the plan of updating it and patching it and making it secure. Whereas a penetration test is, they're trying to exploit things. They are not trying to see, like, yes, maybe they are looking to see what is vulnerable, but there's, the goal is not to fix it. The goal is to say, how can I take advantage of this? From a hunter's perspective, and if people are running penetration tests, I hope that they have their, not only their SOC and a threat hunting team together while they do this. Because one thing that I, so, you know, the whole red versus blue, I'm always a proponent for the purple team. I'm always for, if you are having a penetration test run in your organization, the quickest wins come from that purple aspect, which is really just the mixing of the red and blue teams. So you have the penetration testers sitting side by side with a hunter or a SOC analyst, and they're saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do. Let's see if this triggers an alert. Or let's see if you can hunt for something like this and then detect it. Because if you can sit there, and of course, the goal isn't to have the penetration tester, you know, spill all their secrets, which some, you know, I've heard in the past, well, why would you do that? Because then they get caught. Well, listen, the point is not to get caught or to catch the red team. I understand some people see it as gamified, but ultimately, this is a, the goal is to improve your organization. And if you can have to sit side by side and in real time say, oh, wow, we don't have that visibility, that command that they just threw in an application or something, they don't have that visibility, we need to increase this logging like ASAP. So that, you know, or at least say, these are the tools that we can use to capture that, is incredibly valuable just from that conversation. But I really like that discussion as well. And the rest of the article is, it really highlights, you know, what a penetration test is and what the value is. And I really like this, especially once again, the meat and potatoes, that the eight aspects. So it gives you actionability, if that's a word, out of this to say, hey, you know what, let's start, you know, if someone's reading this, they can say, you know what, while we're waiting for a penetration test, what can we do right now to check on our passwords, to check on our software? So
something that you brought up that I think is a really good point is, you know, you talked about purpling, which I think is really important. But when people pay for penetration tests, you know, I've seen a lot of times where everyone wants to do it like, oh, it's in the dark, no one knows it's happening, it's a huge secret, whatever that means. And I feel like you kind of got to realize what you're paying for in the different versions of the pen test you're doing, right? Because if you're paying for, like, let's do it in the dark, no one knows what's going on, I don't think you get as much value other than you're kind of paying for a live competition that you may win a trophy at the end. And you're spending a lot of money to do so. I do think doing certain things in phases, like, for instance, try to do an external pen test, right? How can they fish effectively? Can they get in through anything? Validate that. Then actually give them access. Unless they need to work that hard, give them just basic access. Like if they did like the scenarios where they maybe got access internally, because one, you're saving on time, which is money. You know, the longer you have to pay them for, you know, yeah, make them work really hard for a month. Well, you just pay for a month. You could just give them credentials and they'd prove a lot more once they're inside, right? And then when they're inside, it's almost better like, oh, you know, you don't have to necessarily stop them, but can you watch them? Can you see what they're able to do? And then based on their reports, report out, say, yeah, you know, we're able to connect the dots with everything you've done. Because let's say you stop them, then you don't know what other things they could have validated for you, right? You kind of run into the like, all right, well, we really kind of like, I guess, we're able to kind of pat ourselves on the back, but also get not the maximum value from the fin test. Versus if you can sit there and kind of show the breadcrumb trail of what it is you're looking for and what it is they're doing, then you can validate, like, look how great our visibility is. They were able to go from here and they went like four different avenues they tried. We were able to see what stopped them and what protections in place stopped them that they couldn't get around. We're able to see where they were able to get around it and where they end up landing. And we can see the entire path. Oh, and on top of that, we can see what detections or whatever or hunts or anything that we may have in place will catch this activity. And if we don't, this is what we actually added from the benefits of that, right? And I think that's what people really want to pay for. But for some reason, the idea of like, well, we're going to trick people and we're going to really show how, you know, these people might not have the right visibility, or they do, I don't know. But I feel like it's disingenuous to do a complete behind in the dark kind of test because you miss out on that value.
Yeah, I think you named it, or you hit the nail on the head too, the time.
Yeah.
I mean, here's how I would approach this. The first penetration test would be for testing your environment, visibility, what detections you have in place. One, like you said, can the hunters follow it? After you've matured a bit down the road, like, hey, okay, you know, we had this from the last penetration test, we saw it, we had all this visibility, we put these things in place, we made these changes, increased logging. Now let's try it again, maybe in the dark. Maybe the goal now isn't a penetration test or like a vulnerability assessment.
I still think it should be sprints though, right? I don't think it should be like outside to in. I think it'd be you're in and you'd be in the dark and see what they do, right?
No, I get that. But I'm just saying, like, maybe test them later. Don't just say, I want to see where we're at and go full bore at them.
So
say, I don't, oh, we're doing this. Like, you couldn't find that. Cause if the SOC gets an alert and they start freaking out and then they start winding things up, is that really the best way to, like, in the initial process, is that really the best way to test your SOC's readiness?
Yeah. So I think what's good about the black box is you can test process, right? When they get spun up, what do they do? But, I had a point there too. I was going to think about, so one of the things you see a lot with pen tests, this is the point I was trying to bring up, is sometimes you'll do a pen test and then you'll have the same pen testers come back and they know what they did before and they'll try some of the old things and see if they still work. Like, did you fix them? And if you haven't, that's not good, right? But that's also a good stopgap to say, hey, I want you to test some of the things that worked last time to make sure we fix them properly, right? Or if you can extend your pen test and say, let's revalidate these things before the pen test is closed, that's a great use of your time because then you get it all done at once, right? Depending on how quick the change can be. But
absolutely. But yeah. And of course, that all depends on what the appetite is of the organization and what quick win they want.
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing here is that you should have a plan. And you should know what the outcomes of that plan should be. Not just, hey, we purchased this because we need to check a box, or we know we need to do this and not really know what to do with it. So, all right, what do you got?
So I have an article from Morphoset named Howling at the Inbox, Sticky Werewolf's Latest Malicious Aviation Attack. So going back, Sticky Werewolf is a cyber threat group. This is by Morphoset, if I didn't say that. The Sticky Werewolf is a cyber threat group first detected in April 2023. In the most recent campaign, they've targeted the aviation industry with emails, which carried with them a Moscow-related theme. So from the, I think they said it was like the general, but it contained LNK files, which we're seeing a lot of lately. That seems to be the new link or malicious file. That LNK file targeted a payload that was stored in a web dev server. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but either way, I had to chat GPT this real quick because I was like, okay, I know I've heard of this before. What is it? But so it stands for Web Distributed Authoring and Versioning. It's an extension of the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTTP, that facilitates collaborative editing and management of files. So a very basic form, and correct me if I'm wrong, this just seems like another web storage technology where adversaries can store their payloads and then have them get called out to in the pack or once the malware runs or a script runs. Is that correct?
Web dev has always been used for fetching things, yeah. Okay. It's like a protocol to fetch stored things. And ironically, there's been a lot of web dev vulnerabilities in the past with how people have kind of exploited it too. It came up a lot for a few years, probably like 5 years ago.
Okay. So once the LNK file grabbed the executable, that executes, then a bash script follows, which leads to an auto IT script, which is multiple baked in capabilities. The idea of this is that, the injected payload typically includes commodity rats or stealers. Recently, Sticky Werewolf has utilized a Radamanthus stealer in Ozone Rat campaigns. In the past, they've used more stealers. So what this tells me is that they're really focused on espionage. If they're doing stealers, they're doing rats and data exfiltration with the tools that are involved. Looking at the techniques that I noticed in the article, first, the executable gained persistence through the use of the run registry keys, which is T1547.001 on the MITRE ATT&CK matrix. Ironically, the script, I believe it was, gained persistence, or the auto IT script, gained persistence as a scheduled task that targeted it in a startup directory. So that whole, which is also T1547.001, because that's the technique that captures the auto start location for registry run keys and the startup folder. I think this is the first time that, and maybe it's just the first time I remember it, but I was surprised that it was the first time I saw that it used both of those sub techniques, that the startup run registry key and the startup folder. Now, something that I also noticed was delayed execution through the use of ping, which at this instance, it said it used the parameter -n, which is the number of pings it's going to send, and it was 193. Now, that sticks out because that's quite the random number. But I would say be careful, if you are, going, once again, coming from a hunting perspective, whenever we're thinking about hunting, we're all the term false positive always comes up. We talk to prospects about it. We talk about customers about it. Really whoever will listen, because I think some people get, scared, not scared, but overwhelmed by the amount of data. Because not that threat hunting is easy. I mean, once you practice it, just like anything else, you'll get accustomed to, or you'll get a feel for your processes and procedures and what you gravitate towards and so on when you're sifting through data. But if you're testing one of our community hunt packages out and you throw it out and there's all these false positives, yeah, that could be quite overwhelming. But that's the fact of life and threat hunting, is that false positives, you're going to have to be there. We're going to, you got to sift through the data. And in this case, I would look to see, okay, first of all, is ping-n ever used legitimately in my environment? Are we doing any delayed execution for any reason? If it's a script that's pushed through, by our admins, which could make sense because it's still a legitimate way to put a pause in there, if you will. I mean, granted, ping will execute, but you delay the, you could separate two tasks by using that ping command. Now, in the past, I know I've seen detections that have been posted in the community focusing on, capturing that ping. but they'll include a number. Now, and don't get me wrong, if the malware is consistently using the same ping number or amount of pings, I would consider that valid. But as soon as you hard code something like that, you leave yourself open to be blind to all the other variations. And in this case, the variables could be, numerous, right? There's only a finite amount of numbers out there, but really it could be any of those numbers other than just the number you put in the detection. So the way I would approach this is first see if -n is a parameter that's using your environment associated with ping. See what that number is, or if there is like a range that, contextualize that information or find the contextual information. What's the user that's using it? What's the process chain that's using this? Is it, a legitimate one? Can you account for this action being an automated script to help clean up your environment or whatever the case may be? And then once you have those variables or once you have those process chains identified, exclude them, right? Get rid of them. I'm not saying just filter on just the username because that could make you blind as well. But if you find like a specific process chain and you say, all right, we are excluding this, like include the parent process, include the child process, include the parent command line arguments if they're there, the child command line arguments, and filter out on that. What that will do is that should allow you to start seeing these things that may not be accountable for. And I'm not saying they're always malicious. It could be a random user trying to test something and they throw in the -n and whatever number they want, or it could be malicious like this. It could be a delayed attack. But those are the first things that I always think about is when I see data or reports like this. I like to cling to the command line arguments and the artifacts they present and trying to figure out how can I make these general enough that everyone can use them without losing the intention of the command. Well, what were your thoughts?
So to kind of like add to something you're saying too, something else to consider when you look at something like ping is what kind of OS is running. Because I'd imagine if you're going to see scripts with the -n, it would be Linux because it will just basically kick off a process forever, right? Versus Windows, you just expect it to terminate after 4. So you can kind of take that into consideration based on if you're going to use that in your environment that way. But the other thing when you talk about hunting for things, you shouldn't be scared to exclude things that, like you said, a user, like you might go blind to a user. Yes. But then sometimes you run the hunt so you get a clean, anything really interesting that you look at, and then run the hunt with the exclusions being the inclusions. So you can say, give me only the things I excluded, and then do some unique sorts off of that, right? Like, okay, if it's the same user who's always doing it or same account, let's do uniques on the command line. Let's do uniques on the parent process. Is it always the same parent process? Are the command lines always looking the same? It's probably okay, right? Or if there's something weird, it'd stand out right away. Kind of what you were saying, I thought was great. So I just wanted to add those two cents. But the other thing I noticed in the article, which I thought was interesting. So, I've looked at some different ways adversaries have tried to enumerate the LSAS process in order to dump it and everything, the credentials. And one of the ways that you will see use is those task lists that kind of show the processes, and they kind of pipe that over to find string or find, and it allows you to basically say LSAS or some like shortened version of LSAS and then pull out the PID of the process so they can dump it. In this case, they weren't looking for LSAS. They're looking for security tools, right? Looking for specific processes associated to a very number of security tools. So I think that's interesting characteristic only because obviously adversaries will use that for LSAS and they'll use it now for other things. I think it's a decent behavior to say, yeah, if you see task list and find string used in tandem within a short period of time, it's worth looking at what other activities happening on that box or the instance, because I know administrators will use that technique sometimes in troubleshooting, but administrators don't troubleshoot that all the time. And I would say even when I've seen people look for the ID, it's very seldom done that way. They usually will have a GUI and they'll look for things that way as well when it comes to a Windows box.
So that was another behavior that kind of stood out to me is like, hey, something worth noting and, you know, thinking about as far as, is this something I could build some sort of hunt off of? That's all I had to add.
I like that idea of the inverse of, you know, like you said, if you notice a constant, you know, if you exclude it, see what happens, but then, you know, then include it or add it as occlusion, because then you could really sit through it. Because, I mean, really, if they're trying to hide it in our environments and then try and hide with using the things that we do, why not use something that the user or the same user is doing over and over to kind of blend it? That, yeah. I like that. What's next on the agenda?
Yeah, so the next one is kind of a big topic people have probably been hearing about. Mandiant, through Google reporting on their threat intelligence, the article is the UNC 5537 Snowflake Data Theft Extortion. So this is kind of covering where, if you haven't heard about it, adversaries have been seen getting into people's Snowflake instances, which is kind of like a big data repository to do things with data within applications or whatever you want to do with data. It's just a great tool for managing and interacting with data. So huge data store. Well, people have been, or adversaries have basically scraped credentials or gotten credentials from info stealers. So they're able to have legitimate credentials going in to these Snowflake instances and then dumping a ton of data where, you know, when organizations have Snowflake as a tool set, they were putting a lot of their data in there. So now it becomes a great resource for adversaries to have all the data in one place that they can then, you know, pull out and use for whatever they intend on using it for. So, you know, the big thing here is I remember early days in the SOC, and it was funny because anytime we saw malware associated with info stealers, it's kind of like, oh, it's just an info stealer. Kind of affects the user, doesn't affect the organization. Well, you know, that's not the case.
Yeah, things have changed.
Yeah, so it's a much bigger problem and something you should understand. Now, when you think about how these info stealers work, though, a lot of times they're scraping credentials you've saved in your web browser. And I don't know a lot of organizations that have a, you know, you can actually set up policies on web browsers to configure them where you actually turn off the ability for it to prompt you to save your password. Because I know a lot of people, when they get prompted, you want to save this password, it's either an automatic yes every time or it's an automatic no for most people. And that's how some of these credentials will get leaked. Because if you're forcing people to put it in and it doesn't save it in the browser, at least it's not in a place where most credential stealers will go. So that's kind of my theory on, you know, what part of this problem, why it might exist. But the other thing to look at that was interesting is they did provide some of the actions within Snowflake. It's kind of like a SQL-esque style language you use within Snowflake. So the adversary basically did like a show tables to see what was there. Then they would select everything from specific databases and schemas from the target tables they wanted. They even might do like an LS look for internal or external places where they can stage things. But they usually would create a temporary stage where they basically create a temporary database that they want to then copy into to move all the data they want. Because I don't think their goal was necessarily to dump everything in the organization, but they identified specifically what they cared about to dump just that. And then they would use basically a git command that would basically push that targeted stage data into wherever their attacker location was as a file to kind of download it. And why I think those actions are important is some of those actions, when you look at time-based analysis, like if you see, oh, someone's creating a temporary place and copying things into it, you may want to have some sort of like detections or, you know, identifications based on that. You know, showing tables and selecting tables is a pretty common thing for a database administrator. I mean, you can put all these commands kind of together in like a time base, like you see all these commands happen. It could be very telling. So that's something you could kind of look at if you're collecting the right data. The other thing is user agent analysis. So it looks like a lot of the logging for access in Snowflake, that looks like that you can see, I'm blanking on the name of the tool because I didn't write it down, but there was actual tool that was seen that was created specifically for this. But basically, it had its own user agent, as well as they had a tool that they used to basically scrape and check out the data itself to kind of do some recon. Also had unique user agents as well. So if you were just looking at, you know, because the connections are usually there's a command line interface that you can connect with, and there's also a GUI or web GUI interface to connect to Snowflake. You can kind of use user agents to kind of tell legitimate targets that way. That can be very insightful. So kind of an interesting fallout from this. There's a lot of organizations that are barely hit. I don't think a lot of them have been confirmed, but there's a lot listed that's kind of going around. So this kind of just affects how data is being used. And it kind of, to me, adds more significance to things like info stealers, because now web credentials and things like that, when you have especially things in the cloud or cloud-based or SaaS-based resources that actually manage or handle your data, info stealers can have a lot more impact than, say, if you were accessing things internal to you and things being stored that way. So, yeah, just kind of an overview, make people aware, give some people some food for thought. What'd you think?
So there's a couple of thoughts here. And one key point that you made, you mentioned if you are collecting the appropriate one. So in my mind, this really expands the visibility, or doesn't expand it. It talks about the visibility issue from a customer or client perspective, right? You have all these logs, and even if it's Snowflake or some other third-party application or whatever you're looking at, what is the value of ingesting those logs? Now, granted, each application, it takes time to evaluate which log sources you need, which log sources add visibility or not visibility, but value to it. Because this right here, looking at the commands that were issued, this was all Snowflake internal. Or to my understanding, that they used Snowflake tools, they used Snowflake CLI. It was all there. So there's no Windows, and I'll say Windows, living off of LAMP binaries here, because we always like to mention that, you know, different PowerShell commands or, you know, WMI scripts, whatever the case may be. This is all exclusive to the Snowflake application. So that kind of raised the concern of, if you are not ingesting other third-party or external application logs, maybe this should be the example that you look at to say, maybe we should start. Another thing that I wanted to ask you, because I had to do this research, but what is Snowflake? I keep hearing the term, but what is this application really doing?
So yeah, Snowflake is supposed to be like an intelligent application where you can kind of throw all your data at it. And then it becomes very easily usable to interact with the data and use the data for whatever your, you know, heart's intent is. And if I remember correctly in past conversations, now that I might not remember this exact, but I also think Snowflake does a really good job with data storage as far as data deduplication. So as you're throwing data in, you're kind of able to not have to worry about duplicate data. It can kind of do some optimizations and things like that for you as well. But like, I think of Snowflake, this might be a bad analogy, but Kafka, if you're familiar with Kafka, it's like a data pipeline that makes it really easy to subscribe to and pull data out as you kind of have data hitting the feed. So it made it really easy to build things off of data being moved or collected. And Snowflake, I feel like, is like the same solution as a Kafka solution, except for is data at rest. It's not data being moved on a pipe that you have to attach to and pull things out. It's like where data will reside, almost like a lake, but in a very intelligent way that makes it easy to just basically write apps off of the data without having to like structure the data and do things with the data. But I've personally never utilized Snowflake. I've just watched some things about it, read some things about it, and talked to people about it. But it's been a while since I've really dug back into it since this actually happened. So,
well, and I'm glad I did some research. And I'm glad you mentioned that because that's where my head was at. So to me, that means if this is a tool that you put data into, you select what goes in there. To me, that tells me that there is a huge variation of impact to different organizations. Like, depending on whatever you put in there, that's what's going to be, that's possibly what was exfiltrated. So
if you're a company that relies on data as like your value, you're hit harder than if you're just a company that has like a different product, but you use data to do things better. Right.
Perfect. I think that's the exact snippet I was looking for.
But the utility that was used to pull everything out was called RapeFlake. That was the term, which is not a good term to be hit with, I guess, if you're a Snowflake customer.
But, and I think that's why Mandy attracts it as Frostbite.
Right. The PC version.
I mean, what are you gonna do? They're attacked. They're criminals. And ask them to be PC.
Right. So yeah, what do you have next?
One of our favorites, as always. If you've been following anything Cyborg, we've probably pushed this many, many times. But the newest DFIR report came out, or the DFI report, however you want to say it. This is named Cyborg Iced ID brings Screen Connect and C Sharp Streamer to Alpha V. For Alpha V or Alpha ransomware deployment, however you want to say that. Always, always a great standard of report. Summaries, pictures, log sources, the evidence that they have. But I'm going to just kind of skip through this and hit the high points of the attack and what I saw as significant, what you could really hunt for. So looking at initial access, we see it was a malicious email with a link. This, which wasn't not an LNK file, but a link itself. So it's going back to the old days. It contained a zip file that, when extracted, contained a README and a Visual Basic script. So basically, at first it popped up and the user could read what it's about. But then the Visual Basic script gets run and it pulls down a DLL. Now this DLL was ICE ID loader, which gained persistence via a scheduled task that executed every hour after login. So I think within this same podcast or episode, we've been able to name three different very common means of persistence. But this scheduled task executed every hour after login, to maintain that insurance there. Then in the execution phase, there was ICE ID was used to install a legitimate remote monitoring and management tool, or RMM, named Screen Connect, which was renamed on the machine, which I then quickly added to my list of growing RMMs. And I know you mentioned that you wanted to, or that you have to see this list. And let me copy and paste it real quick, because while I was researching these, I realized that I had this list, how can I add to it? And I think I forget which report it was from. Was it Mandiant or CrowdStrike or something? But they had a list that was in there too. So I used that to populate it. But Screen Connect, using those tools that are used legitimately to maintain the machines in your environment to make sure, to administer them remotely, using it in a malicious way. But then for lateral movement to spread this Screen Connect, they used MSI exec to install this. So they, once they copied this all across the machines, they then installed it so they could easily laterally move. Screen Connect also had a form of persistence, but this was in the form of an auto start service. And then through defense evasion, Cobalt Strike was mentioned, or Cobalt Strike was seen again. But it injected itself into the winlogon.exe and run DLL32 app or executables. And going back to the beacon that was actually, that was seen, it used the default pipe names. or default named pipes. So these named pipes are how, and I've actually had to research this multiple times because it still didn't, like, it finally clicked about a couple episodes ago. But this is how processes communicate with each other. And there are some, there are a lot of Cobalt Strike named or default name pipes that if you have that visibility, you can see it and you can hunt on. I think some EDRs captured named pipes. I know Sysmon does. So if you do have Sysmon running, I believe it's event code 17 and 18. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's where the information is. So if you're ingesting those logs and you have that visibility, I would do some research on these Cobalt Strike default names. I think we have, I'm pretty sure we have a hunt package surrounding that. I'd have to double tap that as well. I know we have a lot of Cobalt Strike stuff. With Discovery, IceID was actually the main tool used for it. So all those normal commands that were being run, like ifconfig, netstat, you know, whatever, or and all the commands in the report, they were coming from a pretty, I don't want to say obnoxious, but like a pretty distinct parent process. And I'm gonna try and whip this up. Yeah, like it was run DLL32.exe targeting a DLL with a #1, I'm not gonna say hashtag, in the user's app data roaming directory. And this, I wish I could show it on screen, but yeah, and if you look at the report, you'll see right under Discovery, it's quite obvious that this does not look like legitimate traffic. It's not PowerShell being the parent process. It's not command.exe. It's run DLL32 executing this randomly named DLL, which is wild. And I'm not, once again, I'm not going back to the idea of saying threat hunting is easy. Once you get...
Well, you have the experience.
Yes. This sticks out like a sore thumb. Once you have that experience on your belt, you can say, this doesn't look right. And you can say, I don't even have to explain it. Like, here's why. But so this, you know, Discovery was a lot of IceID. Then there's another legitimate tool that I had to always got to do a lot of research for these. But the soft, perfect net scan tool that's used is a network scanner. Now, it was dropped in into the environment as well, and they said that it always targeted the same ports over and over. And those ports were, where did I find it? It was 135, 445, and 3389. But then there was a few extras that were related to the to a backup solution that they have in place. But those, once in this consistency, seeing the same thing over and over from the same process or executable could be, you know, it goes back to the idea of knowing your environment. Is this normal? Is this normally seen in my environment, or so on? And granted, seeing this after the fact is much easier, because you could say, we never saw this activity, then in these 8 days we saw this different activity. Yeah, that sticks out once you have that trend. But when you're in the heat of things, you know, you don't have that. It's hard to have that big picture view. And then exfiltration. R-Clone was used, which is always a favorite, and they always seem to be mentioned in this report. And finally, the impact was the Alpha ransomware, however you want to explain that. But just to once again highlight the value of this, is there is so much actual information. They give you the, Xcopy was used as well. But they give you the command line arguments, they give you the parameters, they give you the event code that you need to look for this, so you could replicate this in your environment, and it really, really makes our jobs a lot easier whenever these new ones come. And this is something that they recently started. They have the DFIR lab, and they actually have a lab directly related to this report. So if you want to go check that out as well. What were your thoughts, Foley?
Yeah, so you call out a lot of the things, but I just want to add some extra
insight too. So already off the bat, when you see a DLL entry point, which is what I mean by that, when you see run DLL calling a DLL in the command line and there's a comma, after that is the entry point, which means that is the one of the functions that's exposed externally as part of that executable package. So most DLLs need at least an entry point to be able to run something. So there are functions inside the DLL that you cannot directly access. It's actually once the DLL is running, it can access internal DLL or internal functions. So that's what entry point is. But when you use an ordinal, that's really common for a lot of malicious DLLs that have been compiled. Instead of like going off the name of the function, they just basically say, yeah, it's the first function. It's the how it's just basically built. But it's not common in from what I've seen to see ordinals used in normal DLL execution. So looking for the hashtag one or hashtag some numerical thing is always an interesting artifact in general. The other thing that always find interesting is, when you see CMD/C, but you have a .cmd following it. So that's how Screen Connect runs all their, command line or executions of other things. So if you don't see parent command line, you kind of have to do the stitching together. But if you're looking at, say, sysmon logs, you'll see the parent command line and command line. And in this case, you can see this Screen Connect command line from the parent. It looks kind of weird. And then it's the real command line is really PowerShell running, a web download or something like that. Sometimes just looking for those types of things, like it's hard because a lot of administrative tools function similarly where they basically run scripts off of .cmd. So you can't just go off that rule of thumb, but like we've been talking about, as you kind of get used to your environment and you understand what you natively run usually with exclusions and things that can be very obvious. The ordinal, we talked about the ordinal number being the malicious DLL. What was interesting about the scheduled task, you see the same behavior, right? The scheduled task is a way to call that malicious DLL and it has an ordinal in a scheduled task. If it's a legitimate scheduled task, it's probably a known service. It's not going to be called that way. That'd be really weird, even weirder, I would think. I did think it was interesting that they used PowerShell, the two different mechanisms to download things, right? So they had like the new object web client download string method, and they just had the invoke web requests commandlet, which I always wonder if it's just based on like the tools that they're using that are running those commands or different people. But it's always interesting when you see like two different versions of the same technique being utilized. Also, anytime you see admin $ in a command line anywhere, I always find that suspect because you're basically calling out the admin share that's could be disabled, but if it's available, that's how a lot of people move laterally in the environment. So it's not common. It's not common for that to be accessed usually. The discovery commands, I always think seeing CHCP is interesting. I do know in EDRs and things will actually call CHCP. It's a way to determine the language or specify the language for output for things too, from like a language pack perspective. I think EDRs use it because when they pull data back for like their routine check-ins, they need the data to look a certain way. And if you're, another country, but the tool's written in, say, a certain English and certain language pack, they need the data to be consistent. So I think that's why EDRs use it in that regular run, but it's not common when you start looking outside of applications for it to be run. And SoftPerfect, I've actually been playing with that tool based on some other things I'm working on. And what's really cool about SoftPerfect is the way it enumerates everything. It gives you a graphical interface and it also will tell you what shares are available on every single endpoint. And you can double click on the share that's available and it opens it right up. I think when you actually saw me on your machine, when you saw someone on your machine, it was me testing that. And when you were sending me notes.
Oh, versus, was that you?
Yeah. I mean, Notepad, I was actually testing SoftPerfect, unveiling your machine.
Looking at the tool, the GUI looks very user-friendly.
Oh, 100%. But one unique thing in looking at it is you can check an option in the tool that will verify if you have write access to shares. So it'll enumerate all the shares, but you won't know if you have write access. But if you do, in order for it to verify that, it creates a file temporarily and deletes it. The file it creates is delete.me. So if you actually have file monitoring for, say, Sysmon, and you have a, say, .me extension, then you will be able to detect when you're being based that type of scan with that method is being utilized in your environment, right? So kind of a cool anecdote as far as things to look for soft perfect net scans, because adversaries want to be able to write to files. They don't want to just be able to read files. So I can imagine that would be a flag that would be enabled. So you do that with Sysmon 11, or there's the bit code 5145, which deals with logging interactions with any kind of share access that's available. I don't know how verbose that would be on a normal machine, but obviously you enable it on a share. It's good logging to have, but it could be very a lot of volume. So just be understanding that. And then we see WMIC, which is the process, WMIC process call. That happens in environments for some tooling, but it's worth paying attention to. And then I thought it was interesting they moved the ransomware with a large volume of X copies. So it wasn't like they had group policy or something where everything fetched it themselves. It was very mechanical and kind of loud when they're moving the ransomware across the network by doing X copy, X copy, X copy. So sometimes looking for just the same command in bulk, all on the same host or all different hosts, those types of aggregations can sometimes help you identify what's noise, what's not, and maybe interesting behaviors. But yeah, those are some of the highlights I wanted to pull out. That's always a good report.
I'm just playing over here to see if I have the proper visual or visibility so I could see that delete.me in our lab.
Yeah, no, I enabled it in your Sysmon. I changed your config and everything, so I tested it. If you look at...
My normal notepad was open too.
Yeah, okay. I completely took over your machine.
Yeah, that's fine. But that's kind of like a artifact. I know it's not really an indicator of compromise.
Right.
Indicator of compromise would be the executable name. The constant or the behavior exhibited would be that file being created. Because correct me if I'm wrong, if you wanted to change that functionality, you'd have to go in and change the coding, right? Like the functionality of the tool. Or is there like...
Yeah, that one's like pre-compiled. It's a tool from a third party, a known tool. So it's not something like the source code, I don't think, is openly available. So for them to actually change that behavior would take a lot of work. And obviously, people using this tool are either using it because they're not really, they don't care if they get caught, or they don't want to burn capabilities, or they're just low level and this is just the easiest way to get things done. So I wouldn't expect people to try to manipulate that, but if they know that is being detected, at least it deters them from using that tool maliciously, which isn't a bad thing either.
And that seems like something a truly sophisticated actor would do, not just a cyber
right.
or like a run-of-the-mill cyber crime.
Yes. Yeah. If they really wanted to maintain that tool and functionality.
And I confirmed I found it. Really done me. It's always fun. All right. How are you going to send us off?
Nothing super exciting. It's a Zscaler article that talks about Valley Rat, which was a remote access Trojan that they saw. The big takeaways that they were seeing, it was developed by a Chinese-based threat actor. It downloaded files from a HTTP file server in the subsequent part of the attack. And then that same file server is what it used also for C2. So kind of talked to the same location, which is interesting because even in pen testers, like their like rules of engagement are like, don't use the same infrastructure for different parts of the attack because it's easier to identify. But in this case, they didn't really seem to care. They don't have an SOP like that. But what was interesting, and I brought this one up, is two things. They obviously use, like we talked about, they bring in a legitimate executable. In this case, it's WinWord 2013. And they basically pull
it too.
Yeah, but it's susceptible to DLL side loading. So naturally, they're going to get DLL side loading happening. So what happens is they're able to then execute their malicious DLL. There's another file that gets pulled down as well. So you've got basically got three files. You've got the exploitable or WinWord executable. You got the malicious DLL. And then they have another file with a different extension, the PPT. And that actually is a encrypted DLL, but they use their sideloaded DLL, the malicious one, to decrypt the other one to then spin up a SBC host executable hollowed out to do process injection. And then there they go, they're running off with their final payload, which is that injected DLL. So really just wanted to call this out. There's a couple other things to look for other than the DLL side loading. We talk about techniques for that where, when you see executables and DLLs being created within the same directory that's not a programs or systems folder, kind of can be suspect, especially if it's a user-driven folder like downloads or desktop or whatever. But they also create a registry run key. Standard. I mean, it's really interesting. We read about attacks like weekly, and registry run keys is just one of the most prevalent things. I know there's a lot of noise when people hunt for them. We talked about noise in the past, or and previously in this specific podcast session. And yes, there is, but there's a lot of easy ways to also exclude a lot of noise too. And especially if you're looking at Are you looking at new keys being created, keys being read? Kind of the action associated with the run key as well can sometimes reduce a lot of that, depending on your visibility of those keys. And then it also sets file attributes on those files. And this I thought was interesting because they didn't call out how they were doing this. I'm assuming there's an API that you can actually use. But if they're not using an API, they'd be using the TRIB or ATTR. Executable that lets you actually change the properties of a file. And if that's case, then you'd easily be able to identify that via the command line when someone's actually using that executable to change those properties. Like I said, that's the only way I've seen people change properties. And I couldn't see any specific API call out for changing those properties. So something that we kind of do sometimes with threat hunting, right? We can look for technical data. And we have clear hypothesis, right? As far as, hey, I think this is how they're doing it. I think we can detect it this way. I can validate it. And you go through that process. But in this case, they gave a good idea. And based on my own knowledge or some research, I can say, well, this is how this can be done. And I can kind of create a, we call it a kind of experimental, but we can say, hey, this is something else. If we have the time and resources to look for, it might not be bad looking for because it's a behavior they were at least using. You just might not be able to validate your covering down on it specifically how they're executing it. But that was another piece I pulled out of there. But so kind of short and sweet, kind of touched on things we always see come up every week. So I kind of brought it up as well. But what do you think?
So I was fascinated by the commands that were being thrown and the capabilities of the tool. Capturing a screenshot seems like it's in every malware out there now. But the one that really
It's also Windows 11, if you know what recall is.
that's forced if you don't opt out. Is it you have to opt out, or is it you have
No, it's default off right now because of the problems. Yeah.
Smart move. But the one command that I thought was interesting was, I think that's zero and MC, or I'm guessing it's a zero. 0xc, it says restart the current process by creating the same process as a child process and subsequently terminating the current process. So in my mind, and what I visualize this in from a long perspective, is like not like a loop, but a process spawning itself and then dying and spawning itself and then dying and spawning itself. I mean, I feel like that would be something that is could be easily identifiable in logs if you look at like process chains. And if they are, and I know they were injecting into SVC host. I'm not sure if that's in the same vein. Well, a couple of things I want to mention about SVCOs is the reason that, I think we saw it in another report, or the Rugos running into, re-injecting itself into WinLogon and RunDLL32. The big thing there is because, SVCOs and those executables, they're expected to be there. If you open up Task Manager and show the
details. They're all over the place.
Yep. Yeah, they're there. SVCOs is all over the place. But what is being spawned by SVC host is what's interesting. And it also could lead to privilege escalation. So because SVC host has to do some certain tasks at an elevated level, if you inject into like the right SVC host, you could get like system level permissions, which I know we probably mentioned those, the same executables or libmap-lam binaries time and time again. But that's why it's significant. And SVC host is normally like a lot less volatile executable that it can withstand some stuff like that. Like clearly if you process inject, it's not going to quit like some other applications might. But that's how they can stay in there, and that's how they can keep that going, is by injecting into a stable process.
Also trusted. I think that's a big thing too.
Oh, yeah.
That's something it's like sign when you talk about tools that are looking for malicious processes. If it's a process that spins up that they trust and you're able to inject into it, you kind of bypass some of those checks. All right. Well, I want to make sure to mention right now for your Black Hat session, right? A beginner's guide to threat hunting. You could, if you sign up before July 19th, you can sign up at a discounted price. So definitely check that out. Lee's a very entertaining teacher and person in general. So, might be worth checking out. But with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing up next week. And with that, that closes out our top 5 threat hunting headlines for the week of June 10th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.